Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, Sherry Coolidge, Silent Phil on the ones and twos. Sherry, you're smiling. You've got something up your sleeve. You're excited about our interview today with John Cranley, the mayor of Cincinnati. He's back on the podcast. We're on quite a run here of City Hall folks. Christopher Smitherman, Steve Gooden, Greg Landsman, now John Cranley today. We're covering all the bases.
We need to do these interviews anyway, so we might as well just put it right on the podcast.
And thank you so much for the support of the podcast. The listenership has just been really through the roof since we've kind of shifted into, you know, focusing a lot on what's going on at City Hall. So thank you so much for your support of the podcast. Let's jump to it. Let's jump away. We're going to talk a lot of the City Hall stuff with John Cranley, but as we record today, news is breaking that there will be a Banks Entertainment District. This is something we've heard about before. What is that, and what's it going to do?
I mean, I had to go back and look. I mean, this was like a big hope, you know, a couple years ago, and I was like, when did we write about that? And it never, and there just never came to be one. There was like, should it be in Over the Rhine? All that was quickly shut down of like, no, that's not what we're going to do there. And should there be one at the Banks? And this is, and then it never really came to be. And, you know, we always heard that the idea that these, you basically can buy alcohol, you know, in one place and walk around with it and take it somewhere else. There was concern that that wasn't conducive to the idea that people were living in Over the Rhine, living in the Banks, and residents wouldn't like that because it'd be rowdy at night. And, you know, but we just see these in these other cities, and they're a big draw with these fewer restrictions. And we are hearing today, there's an announcement that this afternoon, it hasn't happened just yet, but it's coming today, that they are going, they're moving to do this. It's going to come through council tomorrow, the idea of it. And then there has to be this 45-day waiting period. But these are really like state sanctioned. But it's more than just, oh, we're finally getting this. I think it's really just this big idea that we're going to pivot back to the Banks being an entertainment district. Mm. And, you know, at the beginning, it was like it's been through many iterations to make it a success.
Yeah.
And at the beginning, we have written, you know, ad nauseum about this is what it was supposed to be, townhomes and like all of, you know, and it never really was that original vision. It is what we have now, and the businesses are struggling.
Yeah.
And it's like, what can we do to draw people down there on what's not game days, especially? And, you know, game days don't look like game days used to, and hopefully they will again. But how do we really help, you know, these bars and retail kind of stay alive? And this seems to be the solution. So we'll see what happens with this, but it's a pivot.
So on a practical level, does that mean I can buy a beer at the Holy Grail, walk around the sidewalks just sipping my beer? What does that mean now?
I believe that that's what it is. Instead of like, you know, that hard at the Holy Grail, they have those railings and you're not allowed to take a step past that railing with your drink. And it's like, you know, specific game days, opening day per se, you know, where there's like kiosks in the middle of the road where you can buy alcohol, but that's not every day.
They shut the streets down for that.
I believe this is, we're a little scant on details at the moment. I believe this is going to be every day. And this is, you know, so it'll be interesting to see how people react to that and if, you know, it really does become more of a destination.
Like, I mean, here's, I think, what could be really, when you talk about every day and certainly in warm weather times, you're grabbing a beer at the Moorline Lager House, walking down with your family, you and your spouse having a beer while your kids play at Smale Riverfront Park. I mean, to me, it seems like that maybe is something that can be done here. Maybe. I mean,
I could see portions of it for sure that's attached.
And
we're going to ask very specific questions about what this is going to look like. I have a lot of questions myself, but the idea that it is actually happening just shows, you know, it honestly, it's kind of going hand in hand with the street dining plan of like, this is what these other cities are doing, these more successful cities. And I could see the banks becoming more like Fourth Street Live. And I have always said this. I think that Cincinnati residents, you know, they have the capacity not to be crazy and wild. And I don't think this is going to become New Orleans. Like, it's just going to be just a little bit more of what you're already going out for.
But I think this is the perfect place at the perfect time for this to happen. It really is more of an entertainment type of an area. That's what it's become now with the concert venue coming in. Obviously, the Smale Riverfront Park, the two stadiums, those are really the dominant in the restaurants or the dominant things down at the banks. It's, you know, the residential part of it is more of a secondary, like, oh, that's cool if you want to live there.
You know, do bring up a good point, because if this extends as far down to the music venue, I could see that's really like they're trying to like attach things together, right?
Yes.
That you're going to go to these restaurants and bars before you go to a concert, and then you can kind of walk over to the concert. I think we had a story and some pictures. It is really far along. I walk down there and it is, you know, I feel like it could have a concert tomorrow. It's not actually. There's been not a ribbon cutting, and you know we're in COVID, but it is. It's there. You could see it, and it is as beautiful as they promised it would be.
The other question too, and again, we'll have all these answers on Cincinnati.com. As you're listening to this, though, we'll be there because this will be posted on Wednesday. The other question is like, do you have to have a special cup? I know there are what's called Doras. You know, outdoor, you know, drinking. I can't think of what Dora stands for, but there's one in my neighborhood. I actually live in that in my neighborhood. But you have to have a special cup with your wine or beer or alcoholic beverage in it to be able to walk around out and about on the sidewalk. So,
which makes sense because then you're buying it there and you're not bringing it from home.
Right. Although I do notice some folks walking around, never me, of course, with their Yeti cups, and I'm like, oh, they're just drinking coffee, right?
That's my experience with what you're usually
shaking
drinking.
Shaking his head, no. Should we? So be looking for our coverage.
Yeah, I feel like we could ask the mayor a couple questions. He'll talk about it a little bit, and we'll talk about that street dining too.
Sounds great. Let's jump over. Bring on Mayor John Cranley. Special guest time here on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. Maybe we should call it Tough Questions Time. I don't know. That's sort of what we've morphed into. But I'm pleased to welcome back to the podcast. I think he is our first three-peat guest, Mayor John Cranley. Mayor, how you doing?
Jason, Sherry, good to be back with you.
Great to have you back. Oh, where to even begin, Mayor?
I know where to begin. Ready?
Sherry, take it.
Jason and I, we were just talking about, you know, all of the things going on at City Hall. And I was wondering where you were at when you heard that Jeff Pastor had been indicted and what your immediate thoughts were.
Well, I don't remember exactly where I was. But look, you know, for all three of these cases, it's egregious betrayal of the public trust. And I called for them all to resign. And I was saddened, too, because, you know, I believe very much in the city and in public service. And those actions tarnish public service at a time when we need people to take the vaccine and trust institutions and first responders and the services that we provide. And those kinds of actions, you know, deteriorate the trust that really binds us as a country and as a city and as a community.
So, of course, we've seen both Jeff Pastor and P.G. Sittenfeld accept resignations from the state. In fact, you initiated one of those conversations with Jeff Pastor early on. Do you think that accepting a suspension is the same as resignation? Should they have resigned instead?
Yeah, of course they should have resigned instead. I mean, we have to now pay for two extra council members. That's not fair to the taxpayers. You know, former council member Denard did the right thing in resigning. The taxpayers should not have to pay for this.
So were you caught off guard when there was a second arrest with P.G. Sittenfeld?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't see any of these behaviors personally. And so, yes, yeah, it was very jarring and depressing to see, like I said, colleagues engage in what is allegedly illegal behavior and that tarnishes public service for all the reasons that I said.
So I was also wondering, there had been rumors about Jeff Pastor floating around City Hall that he had taken this trip to Florida that we now see outlined in the indictment. And, of course, he is fighting these charges. But we had heard this, and I had been hearing it for a long time. And back in July, I said to myself, you know what? There's only one way I'm going to actually know, because nothing was really turning up things. Public records requests, like, it just really wasn't coming to be what I wanted to be. So I asked Jeff personally if he had ever accepted bribes, and we had a sit-down conversation. And, of course, he did say no. But had you heard rumors, too?
Well, look, there's always rumors that go around, but I had no personal knowledge of any of this stuff. You know, look, I mean, I people have got to stop engaging in criminal acts. And at the end of the day, they need to be held accountable for their personal actions. And 2020 has been, you know, one of the most challenging years of my professional career, but also some of the most rewarding. You know, the fact is that I am more bullish today on the future of Cincinnati than I've ever been. And, you know, we've been through, you know, COVID, furloughs, recession, George Floyd, epic gun violence. And yet, in the midst of all that, you know, today and last week, we announced the most ambitious plan to make downtown over the Rhine and our neighborhoods more urban and pedestrian friendly. And our shooting numbers have been terrible all summer, but now they're starting to come back down again. Our police are doing great work. We achieved what I think is the second biggest police reforms in the last week.
Mayor, I definitely, I do want to stay on corruption for just a minute. I'm sorry to interrupt. And I do want to talk about this because I do think at the end of the year here, you're coming out of the gate with two, you know, exciting things. And we're going to talk about that, I promise. Let's stay on corruption so we're not jumping all over the place. Hard thing about the podcast.
Mayor, I want to ask you, and you know, we hear those rumors for so long, and I remember having conversations with people. I remember Sherry having conversations with people, not speaking for her, but her and I would talk about things we were both hearing, you know, several months ago. I don't want to assume anything, but if you heard those, does the mayor, the leader of the city, have a role to say something, a role to go to law enforcement? Just what is the mayor's role in a situation like that?
If I had any personal knowledge or experience with law, with criminal behavior, I would absolutely report it immediately.
Yeah,
absolutely. And at the end of the day, these were council members in the legislative branch, and I'm in the executive branch, and I think that council is broken, and there needs to be a lot of reforms to fix it.
When you say you guys are all obviously the nine council members, the mayor, all, you know, independently elected.
Yeah, obviously, and it was clear based on Councilmember Denard and Sittenfeld's actions over many years. They don't work for me, and obviously Councilor Pastor is Republican. They are responsible for their individual behaviors, and their behaviors have hurt the city and hurt the taxpayers, and they need to deal with that.
Given that, and piggybacking off of that, what can the mayor – and look, if this is Mayor Mallory or Mayor Cranley or Mayor Lucan or Mayor whoever the next mayor is, and this happens under their – you know, during their tenure, what is the mayor's role to get this thing – to get things going in the right direction, to chart a new – you know, for lack of a better cliche, you know, late cliche,
well, I mean,
chart a new course?
To give an analogy, Jake, I mean, first of all, as you know, the deals that were being bribed, I was opposed to and stood up for the taxpayer. As an interesting analogy, You know, this year, you know, Larry Householder, a Republican, was indicted for a bill that raises people's taxes on January 1st. I oppose that bill, too. But the Republicans in Columbus, including the governor, continue to support a bill that raises people's taxes. And so, you know, what I'm trying to do every day, and today's another major announcement, is to move the city forward. I have acted ethically and honestly in my career, and I am outraged, and I've called for the resignations of people that have broken the law. And so I will continue to do what I know is right for the city, including announcements today to bring an entertainment district to the riverfront, so that when we come out of this COVID crisis, we will have a city that looks new and different and exciting and is moving people in the right direction.
So the solution has been proposed now. Like today, we're recording on Tuesday, as we've said, probably. The idea of a blue ribbon commission to look at development deals going backwards, and I think we're a little light on details, but I think the one thing that is clear here is that you're going to be asked to appoint people to look at corruption in this city. Do you feel like this is the solution that we need?
I think it's one of many. I think we all, including council, myself, previously elected officials, civic leaders, civic organizations, we need to engage in many public hearings and discussions about how to end this culture on council that has led to three indictments this year. It is awful. It's not the way I acted when I was a city council member. It's not the way anyone I served with that I was aware of did anything like this. And so clearly, it is absolutely the time for reform, to look at our charter, to look at our institution, and figure out how to try to do things differently so these things don't happen. But at the end of the day, when people commit crimes, they get arrested and they go to jail. And, you know, no matter what system you create, I can't change the fact that allegedly three members of council engaged in criminal acts.
Mayor, given this, I mean, and Steve Gooden was on the podcast, I don't know, a couple episodes ago, talking about, you know, not needing another blue ribbon commission or another group of this or task force that. Do you think, given the severity of what has happened in the city and City Hall this year, wouldn't it be better to have a completely independent outside auditor or group come in and take a look at the economic development deals outside of a mayoral appointed blue ribbon commission, a completely outside group, kind of like you did with the street? I mean, not kind of like, but, you know, an outside group in the vein of when KPMG came in and looked at the streetcar deal in 2013. Wouldn't that be better to have that outside group come in and look at economic development deals and how the city does that?
Look, I'm open to all of these ideas. As I've suggested to council members and council member Gooden, I don't think we should rush into any particular solution. And I think we're going to have to evaluate a number of solutions. And I think there should be public hearings and discussion, and we shouldn't be rushing into solutions, but we should be rushing into the conversation about this culture and at city council and how we can change it. But I want to get back to the bigger issues, which is that this is not true of the administration, of the city manager, of our police chief, our fire chief, and the people that are delivering the basic services of the city every day. And I'm angry that three individuals have caused a pall to come over City Hall that is unfair to the thousands of people that work every day to make the city better.
How confident are you? I mean, we've heard U.S. Attorney David DeVillers say, you know, we're still investigating. He said it in various different ways over, you know, various different interviews and press conferences. It was very striking yesterday during Budget and Finance Committee, which you're not a part of, but you did stop in briefly to talk about the outdoor street dining. Can this, given that kind of vague statement, and I'm not suggesting anybody did anything wrong, can they actually approve? Can they put forward the solutions themselves? They were part of this body.
Well, I mean, David Mann and Steve Gooden are not accused of anything. They can absolutely make recommendations as to how to change the culture. And I think that's good. I think the more ideas that come forward, the better. I think it's too soon to know everything that we should be doing, but it's not too soon to start talking about all the different ranges of possibilities of rooting, this whole culture out. I mean, as I've been saying for years, council's got to get out of the business of micromanaging development deals. They're a policy legislative body, and they should stick to that. And I think somehow throughout all this, we got to make that clearer.
Sticking with talking about economic development deals, you in your press conference after P.G. Sittenfeld's arrest on the steps of City Hall, you mentioned Chittenden and Duke Way, and you were
now known as cooperating witness.
As
part of the two indictments related to Jeff Pastor and P.G. Sittenfeld.
You were critical. You were critical in your comments that day. No one asked you about it. You felt the need to say something about it. A, why did you feel that need? And B, can you characterize your relationship with this particular developer?
Well, look, my words spoke for themselves. I stand by what I said, but I also appreciate if he's working with the government. That's not something I want to interfere with, so I don't have anything else to add to that. Look, you guys can absolutely use everything I've already said, and I stand by it. You could tell I'm still very angry about what these three individuals have done to this institution that I've worked so hard for. But in all due respect, I think that the 6 months from now, 9 months from now, 3 months from now, having lived through COVID, epic gun violence, George Floyd, passage of Issue 7, in 2020 will all be far more important than the actions of three individuals who will, get their day in court and be held accountable.
So let's actually talk. So you were touching on this a minute ago. I mean, we are seeing, this record violent crime, although I have to say I've noticed there have also been a lot of these homicides solved. That has been, I think, something that we're seeing the fruits of, previous things that your administration has done. ShotSpotter, it's getting officers more quickly to scenes, and it's getting, some resolution for these families in these terrible times. Where are you at on kind of what's fueling all of this, and how are we going forward next year to keep trying to tamp these things down?
Well, it's obviously a very tragic, depressing, and something I spent a lot of time on. All across the country, you had a huge spike in gun violence throughout the year in major cities. And this resulted from, I think, multiple things happening at the same time. One, you had school get out in March, and lots of people had free time, and it put stress and strains on domestic relations all across the country. Secondly, you had, sadly and tragically, fear in March and April and May in particular, among police officers all across the country around whether they could contact the COVID by doing normal police work. And so while they were still responding to 911 calls, a lot of the aggressive, proactive policing that really deters and suppresses the most serious crime, really was pulled back upon. And it's understandable why, given the health risks that were unknown at the time. And that's just a fact. But what I've learned over 20 years is that once a culture of, bad acting is allowed for just a little bit, it spreads. And, it's an ugly cycle where it gets worse. And similarly, once you start showing that you're going to crack down on illegal guns and gun violence and things of that nature, it starts to move in the other direction. But it crime can expand much quicker than it's reduced, because then once you have shootings, you have then a cycle of revenge and payback shootings and other things that that make it worse. And so that really exploded. And it was once you open the door, it's really hard to close it. And then secondly, of course, you had all this stuff going on around the tragedy and what I call the murder of George Floyd, which led to massive protests around the country, obviously, the defund the police rhetoric, which I strongly oppose. And but you add to the combination of the fear factor of COVID and the, you know, incredible, you know, criticism that the police were taking over the actions of the officer in Minneapolis. And I think that also contributed to additional, you know, culture of violence across the country and major American cities. So, you know, I'm not excusing it. It's not excusing. I just am explaining. I do know that starting in the summer, we've really worked hard to start, you know, despite the fear of COVID and the criticism of the job, to get our officers really back into our gun task force and to working again with the U.S. attorney to go after these repeat gun offenders and shooters. And in recent weeks, we've made the U.S. attorney has made major arrests, and working with his office has been a pleasure, and really going after repeat violent offenders who are sort of on our most wanted list. And I'm confident now that our officers are engaged again and are fully going after the shooters. And what I have found historically is that when we make the kinds of arrests that the U.S. attorney made recently of some of our most wanted, that leads to crime shooting reductions in the short term and medium term. And then obviously, as we get past the winter and into the spring, when more and more people, including our first responders, will have been vaccinated, I'm very confident that we have the police strategies in place to get crime back down to reasonable reductions. Remember, 18 and 19 were two of our lowest years in 20 for gun violence. This year, obviously, has been the worst, which is awful. And so we obviously want to move back towards those kind of expectations around, 18 and 19.
So while this is all going on, one of the big things happening this week is the police union contract. And I do want to talk about that. But, you know, kind of asking a question off of something that you just said, is there a plan in place to get our first responders in the city, you know, some of the first people vaccinated? Like, what does that plan look like?
Yeah, absolutely. Our firefighters and EMS workers, especially, who deal with people that may, you know, have cardiac arrest or something because of COVID, as well as our healthcare workers at our health centers, are being vaccinated now. You know, I mean, it's you know, they are first in line and they will be vaccinated, and our police will be shortly behind as we get more vaccines. And so we have begun that process, and it's very exciting and inspirational. I mean, it really is like, you know, after such a terrible year, to finally get the vaccine and to see hope, and that spring is coming. It's still 4 months away, but it's coming. And it is an exciting way to look forward to 2021 after the dark year of 2020.
Are you planning to get the vaccination?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to jump any line, but as soon as I'm eligible, I will absolutely take the vaccine.
There was one question I wanted to ask you back to all the, you know, the corruption related. And it's a question I've been asking a lot of folks. Asked Greg Landsman on the podcast last week. I can't remember if I've asked you this or not, but I'll ask you again. I think maybe I asked you in the press conference, but is there a moment in time here? You've been in City Hall for almost 16 years between your time on council and your time as mayor. Is there a moment in time, a vote, something where you saw this thing go off the rails and go down the road of the way things have gone for those three council members?
I mean, look, I think there are two different issues. You know, one's criminal and one is just good government, right? You know, we have three criminal allegations against three individuals that are felonies. And so they bear the responsibility for breaking the law. But it's also the case that that I think culturally, you know, city council, you know, the culture of city council's got to change. You know, they can't be micromanaging deals. They should not be bringing in their own legislation to push deals. They should not be as famously Yvette Simpson, tried to get money out of Children's Hospital for neighborhood stuff. You know, that's just not the appropriate role of a council member. I think similarly, obviously the way the council attempted to at the expense of good government, run the city through the Gang of Five text, and that was terrible. And it was not an appropriate role. And I do think that you can't have a city run without a mayor and manager that are working together to improve the quality of life of the city. And if you read the text, which I know you have and I have, they don't ever talk about thinking Harry Black was a good city manager and doing a good job for the services. In fact, they suggest he needs counseling of some kind. And it was all about power, and it wasn't about the public good.
If
you read the text, it was clearly organized by Mr. Sittenfeld, and four other council members went along with it for far too long. I know Greg ultimately changed, and I'm glad he did, but it was a terrible way for the city to govern, and I think among many other reforms, that should certainly be looked at.
What do you think about the idea that investigation is still ongoing? That investigation, the criminal part of the investigation, launched on December 19th, 2019. We are fast approaching the year anniversary. I mean, are you frustrated? Where are you at on thinking what's coming out of that? Because that's...
Well, you mean on the Gang of Five?
Yes.
Yeah, it's obviously very... I mean, I told the members at the time that what they were doing was disastrous for the city. If you go back to the WCPO article that was written the day that I asked for Harry to resign, I specifically mentioned that there were deep morale issues at the 911 call center. And if you remember, Christensen was the woman that had sort of claimed retaliation by the city manager. And I was pointing to those things about the delivery of basic services. And I told the council, all the council members at the time, that the city had vital interests that needed to be better served and that needed to move forward. And you just can't have a situation where the elected mayor and the manager can't get along in order to move forward, especially when there was clear cases of retaliation and abuse that was happening that was hurting the functioning of the city. And so, fundamentally, I think that the council has got to get out of, you can't have a situation where if the mayor wants to fire the manager, that the council can stop it, because that led to a lot of very bad things. And we told the council members at the time that it would lead to a lot of bad things. I didn't think it would lead to a criminal investigation, and I didn't think it would lead to breaking the law and five members of council, claiming in court that they broke the public records law. But it turns out it was wrong for even more reasons than I realized.
What's your takeaway from the fact that investigation still isn't done?
I don't know. You'd have to ask Hanley. I don't know him personally, so I don't know.
Do you believe at the crux of a lot of this culture is a disdain for you? I mean, certainly we look at the power. You mentioned the word power and a power grab when it came to the Gang of Five text messages. We've seen some of the what's in the indictment for P.G. Sittenfeld about how, he can deliver the votes or he has the votes. Do you view those things as a direct, disdain for you, for lack of a better word, but, that it's directed at you and how much some folks can't stand you and maybe vice versa?
You'd have to ask them that. All I can say is that I served on council with Mayor Mallory and Mayor Lukin, and I always, even if we disagreed on an item, for example, I wasn't for the streetcar, Mayor Mallory was. We had honest and fair debates, but we were extremely respectful of each other, and I would never have, as a council member, tried to usurp the powers of the mayor or hurt the functioning of the city for trying to create some sort of a group of five to run the city from council. I think the idea of creating permanent cliques or parties in council is a terrible idea. Every issue should be debated up and down on its merits, and there are changing coalitions all the time, and should be all the time. That there are nine members of council, the mayor, and we see things differently, and we need to have those open and fair debates. And that's how I conducted myself as a council member and certainly as mayor, and I certainly encourage others to do so. And I think that is certainly was a huge problem that maybe could be fixed as part of all the different reforms that need to be looked at as a result of these indictments.
Was it a bitterness that you were elected not once but twice?
You know, I'm proud of the fact that I've been elected twice. And I think, you know, after 70 years of population decline, the city is going to show an increase in the census this year. And I'm proud that that'll happen after 8 years of me being mayor. But I also want to point to that I believe that the transformation of the city from declining to rising, or stabilizing the losses and starting to rise, I think really did start with the collaborative agreement and 3CDC and the public-private partnerships that Mayor Lucan started that were continued and accelerated by Mayor Mallory and has accelerated even further under our administration. And I do think that the change to a stronger mayor, directly elected mayor, is not a coincidence that we're seeing a turnaround in population decline and in growth at a time where there's finally a mayor that everyone recognizes as the leader of the city. You know, obviously, you know, you win an election, you lose 45% of the vote. Obviously, there'll always be critics. But I think if you look at the record of the city's turnaround over the last 20 years, there are many contributing factors. And I think the two biggest factors have been the collaborative agreement and the public-private partnerships like 3CDC and others. But I also think that having a strong mayor that is clearly the leader of the city is also helpful, because it gives everyone on the outside who's dealing with the city one point of contact to try to get things done.
Do you want to see a stronger mayor system in terms of basically at some point phasing out the city manager form of government and have it completely a strong mayor?
You know, I think all those things to be debated. Obviously any changes would not affect my term.
Sure.
and should not. So, you know, I don't really want to get into the detail. I mean, I'm open to it. I think all those things should be discussed and fully vetted by the public and ultimately, if it's a change of the charter, by the voters.
Couple things. You talked about you were talking about, you know, council and coalitions and the makeup of council, and two things on the current council as you move forward into 21. Probate Judge Ted Winkler is in the process of looking at appointing a temporary replacement for P.G. Sittenfeld, who's been accepted a suspension. Who do you want to see get that seat?
You know, I'm going to stay out of that. You know, the names that have been floated are all good people, and I have to work with whoever he picks. So, you know, the better option would be for the council members to resign and have the charter determine how people are picked. But that's not what they decided. And I have come to have a deep respect for Judge Winkler. I think Councilman Gooden was a great choice, and I'm sure he'll make another great choice.
And along those lines, essentially, effectively, the removal or the suspension of P.G. Sittenfeld removes really the ringleader of what we're talking about, the Gang of Five. So, and Tamaya Dennard is already off the council, so the Gang of Five really is no more. You're looking at really potentially having, after your first 7 years as the mayor, a very antagonistic relationship and with council, to potentially now having a majority of council that will work with you. Can you talk about that and going into 21 and what maybe some of your agenda will be, knowing
Absolutely.
That you have
and
a favorable council to work with?
Look, you know, politics ain't beanbag. I'm a big boy. I've been through a lot, obviously. And you're right that there has been some, antagonism from the beginning. I remember, you know, obviously there were protests for the streetcar the day I was sworn in, and you also had, you know, three council members, Seelbach Young and Yvette Simpson, write an op-ed before I'd been in office for 3 weeks, basically declaring, like Mitch McConnell did against Trump, that they were going to spend their time opposing me. They refused to meet with me most of the time for those 4 years. And obviously, the text messages revealed a plot by the council members to try to usurp the power of the mayor and manager, not because they thought the manager was doing a good job, but just for power. So you're right that there's been some challenges there, but here's the good news.
To say the least.
Despite all that,
that's one way to put it.
We're seeing the fastest growth in the city in 70 years. We've seen an adding of 8,000 or 9,000 jobs since we've been mayor. We've seen FCC, you know, break ground and is going to open up their stadium in this spring. We've got a resolution, which will continue, by the way. Additional efforts will be needed, but we made major progress on the pension. And every neighborhood I know, from Price Hill to Walnut Hills to Madisonville, you know, when I was on council in the mid-2000s after the racial unrest in 2001, people were in a bad mood. And I have seen a contagious feeling of optimism and positivity throughout the city. And then this year in 2020, we passed a transformative investment to make sure the Western Hills Viaduct will get fixed and bus service will be expanded throughout the city. Now, going into 2021 and looking at what we are going to have to finish through all the work of 2020, I feel it's been some of the most productive, despite the distractions of the criminal indictments, I feel it's been some of the most productive time of my professional career. I told people many times over that I never thought I would ever have to face issues as tough as 2001. And 2020 is like that times 100 in terms of the public health
challenges. I mean, I'm not great at math, but I'm gonna get on board with that analogy.
And just for context, 2001 being the civil unrest and the civil unrest,
which really was I was a very young council member at the time. It was a baptism by fire. It was a miserable time. And out of that tragedy and difficult time and injustices that were brought to bear, massive changes occurred, including the creation of the Minority Business Accelerator, the collaborative agreement, 3CDC, the public-private partnerships that have helped lead to a renaissance of our city. And I'm proud to say that I was part of all of that as a council member. But it is now, I think, a time where we're accelerating and we're going to be able to take all the difficulties of 2020 and put Cincinnati on an even faster course of renaissance. There is no city in the Midwest that is doing as much to give small businesses like restaurants a chance to survive like we are. The announcement, the passage of the thing out of committee yesterday, when people come back downtown in April or May, after they've been vaccinated and it's safe and it's warm again, they're going to see a brand new Court Street that is pedestrian friendly, a Liberty Street that's pedestrian friendly, a Fountain Square where the old Macy's was, which has got outdoor restaurants and seating. And then all the existing temporary things that were stopgap measures for restaurants will be permanent lane closures. And it's going to feel like you're walking in a European city with outdoor life and vibrancy. And Sherry, you may remember, when I was a young council member, I proposed that Main Street become like a Beale Street. And today we're announcing that the banks, including Tony Cafeo, who was a restaurateur down at Main Street at the time, who now runs Jefferson Social down at the banks, we're going to have an entertainment district at the banks right next to the Red Stadium that's going to feel like Beale Street.
An outdoor
entertainment district that will be ready by spring that will help us celebrate the end of the pandemic and the beginning of red season. We went to the playoffs in the COVID. Let's go to the World Series in a normal year.
I do want to say, you said yesterday, I thought this was interesting, during Budget and Finance Committee when this was being discussed, and it looks like it does have the support to pass, that you know, this is what these other big, vibrant cities do, and that you had traveled and seen some of this. And I was thinking as I watched that, this is what big, vibrant cities do. And it is – I remember you saying that about Beale Street. I do way back then. But going forward, like that comparison, I liked that comparison a lot for this city.
Yeah, look, we would not have launched the ambition of – this many essentially streetscapes all at the same time if it hadn't been for the crisis of COVID, because tragically and sadly right now, but for understandable reasons, downtown is empty. You know, people are working from home. And so, you know, if there's ever a time to invest in improving the look and feel of sidewalks and streets, it's right now. So, and that's one of the reasons why we're rushing this legislation through this week, is because we literally want to be under construction in December and January, so that when it does get warmer and March and April come around, there really is a chance for these restaurants to win back the business that they lost because of COVID, and to, as a, you know, the whole world is going to want to celebrate the end of the pandemic safely. And I'm not saying that everything will be perfect by April or May, but it'll be a lot better. And it'll be time to start gathering again, because we're humans and we're meant to have social contact with each other. We're not supposed to spend all of our time on Zoom. Eventually, we've got to be back in touch with each other personally and physically. And I want to build this city so that restaurants are coming out. You know, there's going to be huge pent-up demand to come back out downtown and celebrate. And unfortunately, many cities and, frankly, some of our own restaurants won't make it through the winter. And that's really, really sad. And I'm doing everything, including the subsidies. We did $17,000 per restaurant to get them through the winter. But the fact is that, you know, a lot of cities, even though they'll have the pent-up demand, will no longer have the business infrastructure that we're going to have to still be there. And so when we're there, I think we're going to gain and continue to gain the reputation we had prior going into COVID of being a comeback city that's got this incredible charm, architecture, and ability to really accommodate people, you know, going forward.
Sounds like your stump speech for statewide office there.
Well, you know, we'll deal with that later. But, you know, right now there's just so much to do in managing the vaccine, COVID, and, you know, getting the city, you know, gun violence down and helping these businesses survive this dark winter ahead of us.
Well, I know you say you'll deal with it later, which, I mean, you can do both at the same time, which you've done in your career. You are going into your final year before your term limited on as the mayor. 2022 is right around the corner. You have obviously launched you're looking at running for governor. You're continuing to explore that. At what point does it become an actual full-on campaign? You are running for governor.
Well, I haven't made that decision yet, but presumably sometime in 2021. And all, you know, all I'll say about that is that if you look at the state of Ohio under, you know, you've got, you know, a huge scandal right now, and you know, the difference between our scandals and theirs is that they are still raising taxes on January 1st to pay off their bribes. Whereas, you know, I opposed the deals that were being bribed upon here in the city of Cincinnati. And so the taxpayers are still going to pay for the bribery in Columbus. But bigger picture.
That's rate payers.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's like a tax. You can't live without your heat and heat and air conditioning.
But yeah.
So the fact is that there's been one party rule. Republicans have run the state basically unbothered for 30 years. And Ohio used to be above U.S. per capita income. Now it's below. Cincinnati and Hamilton County is above U.S. per capita income. And while most of the state is declining in population, Cincinnati is rising. So at a very big picture level, Ohio needs a comeback. And we're one of a few comeback stories in the state of Ohio. But, you know, having said that, you know, whatever I decide to do, I'll probably announce some point in 2021.
I mean, you have a strong record from your time as mayor. Really, you're one of few people on the bench, I think, that can be competitive statewide for the Democrats. What's it going to take for the Democrats in Ohio to get back in the game?
You know, fundamentally, we've got to have relevant policies that will grow the economy and opportunities of the state. You know, we have got to have specific ideas that will bring jobs to Appalachia, to the northwest part of Ohio, to the Youngstown area, in addition to seeing and making sure that the wonderful growth of our cities and economies of our city remain vibrant. And I think that when you've seen the loss of manufacturing jobs, the loss of population in a lot of the smaller towns and rural areas, you know, we need very specific ideas on how to revitalize those communities.
So, but you're one of the people in your party that talks about those things, but The electorate, especially, as you know, you and I have talked about it a lot, where I'm from, the southeast part of Ohio, and you go over there and you spend a lot of time over there and all the way up to where Sherry's from in the Mahoning Valley. And those areas continue to trend toward the Republicans. And I think a lot of it has to do because of jobs and because the Republicans are speaking more to the working class. And the Democrats, and again, whether this is the Ohio Democrats or the National Democrats, are worried more about an ideological purity test. You're someone who is very practical and a pragmatic Democrat. Are you pushing for your party to move back toward that? And I'm talking about your party being the Ohio Democratic Party.
Yeah, I am, certainly. I think that we've got to be, at a very big picture level, we've got to make sure that kids are educated at school, in person, because it's clear that they're not getting the education they deserve now. We've got to be the party of jobs and helping small businesses, not shut down small businesses during this COVID. We've got to be the party that has a real way to rebuild the middle class and, leverage, for example, the natural gas explosion in eastern Ohio to bring good-paying jobs and secondary industry jobs that can benefit from the explosion of natural gas. And, of course, there are lots of jobs, as I'm helping to create myself, by investing in the largest solar installation in the country led by a city that is also going to put good-paying jobs to work and building a cleaner energy future as well. So, those are just some of the things that I think we as Democrats have got to do.
So, unlike the leader of your party, you are not in favor of banning fracking, leader of your party being Joe Biden.
Well, he doesn't either, but no, of course not.
Well,
fracking and natural gas is much cleaner and it is a massive ability for the country to be energy independent. Obviously, as the leader of the largest solar investment led by a city in the country, I want to see a cleaner future for energy too, but that's going to include natural gas, and it's certainly vital to Ohio's economy.
Speaking of the president-elect, Joe Biden, what my favorite rumor is in the last, week or so? That you might be going to his administration. And I know that you are very, focused on HUD and these urban issues. Is that something, anyone approached you? Is that something you would consider doing?
No one's approached me. I have no reason to believe that is happening or under consideration under any level. Of course, if he called me, I would take the call and it would be flattered, but I don't believe that's going to happen, and I'm not putting any time into that.
And you had been in discussions in 2016, had Hillary been elected, which you raised a lot of money for Hillary. You had her over to your house, that there was a potential of you going and working in her administration. So I just wanted to share that with listeners that was a possibility. I don't even know why. It just made me think of that.
It is one of the reasons. It's one of the reasons why the rumors are floating.
News to me, but no, I am proud to have supported both Hillary and Joe Biden, and I am very much. I am very disgusted by the way that our election system has been attacked unfairly over the last 8 weeks. I think the Secretary of State of Georgia, the Governor of Arizona deserve profiles and courage awards for not buckling under outrageous and unethical pressure by the president and his allies to subvert what's so important, which is free and fair elections in this country. And so I'm extremely happy that Joe Biden won and will become president on January 20th.
We've covered a lot here. Is there anything we want to ask about the banks or this?
No, I think it's fair to say that I could ask you 1,000 questions for the whole rest of the day, but we'll let you go. We know you have a busy schedule today.
Hey, thank you. And look, as I want to go back to something I said at the beginning, obviously, and it's fair points and questions, we have the outrage of three people being arrested for allegedly criminal acts. But I am confident, and not surprisingly, people's lives affected by COVID, affected by gun violence, affected by businesses that have been facing lower demand and shutdowns, 3 months from now, 6 months from now, you know, those will remain the more important issues. And I'm proud that we got this city with a credit rating that wasn't diminished, with no layoffs ultimately after 1,700 furloughs, and that we have a plan to reduce the gun violence and help these small businesses get through the winter. And then on top of it, you know, we're the first major city to get arbitration reform with our police department. And so we can walk and chew gum. We can say simultaneously that we love and support our police officers. But like any human institution, occasionally there are humans that make mistakes, and they've got to be held accountable when they do. And so we got in the contract the ability to more easily hold officers accountable when they do bad things. And I think that's a huge accomplishment that I'm very, very proud of.
Absolutely. I commend you on that, Mayor, and you and I have talked about that. I think there's some mayors in other major Ohio cities that could follow your lead on that, but that's a conversation for another day. Thanks so much for – I know we jumped around and covered a lot of ground today, and really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us today.
Thank you, guys. Thank you very much. Have a Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Hanukkah, and all the rest.
Thanks, Mayor.
Thanks, Mayor. Same to you.
All right,
bye-bye. Thanks again to Mayor John Cranley. Covered a lot of bases there, Sherry. Jumped around. A lot of things going on. Just glad we were able to get some questions in there about the mayor's pursuits of running statewide as well. Let's shift gears and let's go from one. You don't get much more Cincinnati than John Cranley, but that's a bad segue. But you know what? What the hell? We are in our That's So Cincinnati moment or moments of the week. And Sherry,
you all can't see Jason today, but he is proudly in his Marshall hoodie and it's bright green. And you know what it makes me think about? Christmas.
And I'm wearing my Bearcats hat, although it's not red, which would make me really look like a Christmas tree. But my That's So Cincinnati moment of the week, or my That's So Cincinnati ordeal of the week.
Oh boy.
I absolutely, absolutely love King Arthur's Court toys in Oakley. It's got to be one of the last kind of neighborhood independent toy stores, I would think, in America, certainly in the Midwest. You don't see these types of toys, but this place just thrives. And I really made a concerted effort this year to try to shop local and local businesses for my kids and my wife. And was there on Saturday and got my kid's main Santa Claus Christmas gift, my kid, my 8-year-old's. And
I feel like he's not listening as much as we like our families to listen. Alex, what did you get him?
I got him huge Lego City police station.
We have had two of those. They redid it 1 year, and he needed the second one. I was like, how many does your city need? Two Lego police stations?
Oh, yeah, you could go with two. Absolutely. So it's just cool because we've actually been spending more time there, I guess, during the pandemic, because they have a play area downstairs now at King Arthur's Court, like a little zip line, slides, and little swings, and a little bow and arrow target area. Well, I mean, it's all, toy stuff. No, it's not. Yeah, like it's real bows in there. And so we've gone the last couple weekends. I went by myself last Saturday to get the Christmas gift. But just love that place. Shout out to the folks who work there and who just do a great job. They have popcorn and families were in there shopping. And it is a great place
and it's still there.
It's like Christmas.
Yes. We're a little bit past that since Jack is 12.
Yeah. Yeah, on Madison Road there. Shameless plug for King Arthur's Court Toys in Oakley.
But it is very much part. I mean, I think if you talk to people in Cincinnati, like our people our age buy their, children presents there, and people have grown up with it too. So we were Christmas shopping too, also local. We went to Rookwood.
Rookwood Pottery.
To the factory. They have a lovely shop in there. And so it was such a nice visit in there. It was very Christmassy, and we bought a lot of our presents for people there.
Nice.
I can't say what they were, though, just because
Yeah. Because there's adults who listen.
My friends might be listening.
That's the factory. It's up in Over the Rhine, right?
Across, yes.
Across,
yes.
You know why I know where it's at? Because it's, you know what it's across from, right?
I do.
It's the streetcar garage.
Yes.
And right around, just a hop, skip, and a jump from one of my new favorite places, Northern Row Brewery.
Oh, I haven't been there.
It's awesome. It's in the old one of the old Christian Moore line.
That's right.
Brew factories. And it's just a neat place. And
no, I mean, you can go up there. There are things like all the way up and over the Rhine, pretty north of things to do. And you know, there's a, names are escaping me at the moment. But
Northern Row Brewery is so Cincinnati, because everything in there has to do with it has a story. The tables, the bar arch thing, the wooden massive thing behind the bar was from Brunswick, which used to make bowling alleys, and that was here in Cincinnati. They found this thing out in Kansas City, refurbished it, brought it back here. The lights inside the restaurant bar area are from the old Cincinnati Gardens. So it's like the old gym lights are kind of the lights at Northern Row. So there's everything in the tables. There's all a story in there. There's old railroad wheels. I don't know what they're called, but that are at the ends of every table.
I think we're going to have to go, although I suspect your meeting source is there. I mean, I know you, so
yes.
I'm just guessing.
Had a good source meeting there last week, and first time I was able to take him there and
introduce him. The one thing I have found about the breweries, Taft, Rheingeist, is they are so large. Like, they're the kind of places that really can accommodate during all of this, like the social distancing. Like, you can go and have your own table and be very far apart from another table. And so when we're going out, I've noticed that's like a good destination for people who really want a social distance.
Mad Tree has done a fantastic job with the distancing and the flow of keeping people apart.
Yeah, they have the space.
Yeah, they've done a really great job. I have not been to Rheingeist, so that's not a indictment on them, because I just haven't been. I'm sure they've done a good job too.
I have to say, the outdoor dining plan, the mayor did touch on that, and we've written a little bit about it too. Mm-hmm. Look for those stories. But that is going to just be a huge boon for these restaurants, and they're going into the streets. There's some temporary ones now, but with these ugly orange barriers, and like, these are going to be more permanent parts. It was Brandon Ruby.
Yep, Brandon Ruby.
He spoke at budget committee yesterday and said, they're going to have one of these, and he really is looking forward to making it their own and unique to what Jeff Ruby's is. And so I thought that was, I was like, I caught that. I was only listening with half an ear. Our regular listeners will notice I didn't write a story out of budget committee, but I was paying attention to what was going on, and he was talking about the importance of all of that. And so, but that is really like, coming out of what will be a harsh winter. Because it gives them the space, people can feel comfortable outdoors, but it lets them, social distance people.
This is the moment in the episode where I like to ask people to, if you haven't gotten a subscription already, please get it. And I have a special thing to talk about today when it comes to getting that subscription. And that is, over the weekend, the debut of the Year That Revealed Us documentary done by Amanda Rossman, Meg Vogel, and narrated by Dan Horn. Sherry, you were part of a team that wrote stories, and it really a huge part of our newsroom were involved with this. It's just interesting to be in here as we're in the studio right now, and it's the first time in a long time that we've been in here, and Amanda and Meg haven't been in the back corner, hunkered down in front of all the video equipment, just working their butts off to try to get this thing done, and they got it done, and it is outstanding. So please go check it out. That's the Year That Revealed Us documentary. Just go on Cincinnati.com. You can find it, search for it, and watch that. And if you don't have a subscription yet, please watch that and decide. And I would really encourage you to think, this is the power of local journalism. This is the first real this is the first major documentary. Our team, our uber talented photojournalist team, led by Kara Owsley, has done. And we can't.
It was amazing. I was crying. They made me, you know,
goosebumps like galore.
They made me think, you know, I'm so into like I can be in a city hall bubble and not know what's really going on.
Yeah.
You know, and I have pushed, you know, the idea of what's going on around like the pandemic, you know, to the back of my head like a lot. But it really, you know, made me think about all the things in our own community that people are dealing with and how everyone's coping. And like I loved it so yeah. much.
And that is the power of local journalism, and it can't be done without your support. And so I don't know how if you don't have a subscription already and you watch that and think, gosh, I got to get a subscription because I want to support this kind of work and this kind of passion for our community. And no one else is doing this kind of work. And I know I keep saying that, but again, that's another great example to show the power and influence of what we're doing and the importance of what we're doing and a whole new thing. And we can't do something like that without resources and without your commitment to supporting us and Cincinnati.com and the Inquirer. So I want to reiterate, you have a subscription already. Thank you so much. If you don't have a subscription, obviously you're listening to this podcast. Thank you as well. But please, I would encourage you, Cincinnati.com/subscribe. Check it out. I just saw we're having like 90%. I saw something on Facebook. We're having like a Christmas deal right now. That's like 90% off or something like that. So check that out. Give us a try. And as always, you're going to get plenty of politics and government coverage from Sherry, myself, Scott Wardman, our team in Columbus, Jesse Ballmert and Jackie Borchert, and Carl Weiser, our fearless leader, who is a digital machine and understands digital journalism as well as any editor in America. And our top editors, Burl Love, Michael Perry, are just so supportive of the work that we're doing here, and you know, give us the green light to go out and report, and that's what it's all about. Is the reporting is at the core of all this. So, thanks so much for listening, and we will, we have some fun things planned here toward the end of the year. So we'll catch you next week.